my more wayward summer meanderings of these past couple of months took me and my wife Michelle to a little bump in the road of a town called Coldwood, West Virginia. We actually drove for over 2 hours, about 2 hours south of Charleston, where my mother lives. We drove 2 hours mostly over these little two-lane winding roads. Not a trip I would recommend for anybody who is prone to car sickness, because you're going to get it if you go back through there. Fortunately, I did not. Well, there's not much to Coldwood these days. Coal mine that was there closed probably close to 20 years ago now. So what were we doing there? Why did I want to take such a long trip that took up most of the day of the days we'd set aside to visit my mother last summer? Well, I wanted to see where Homer Hickam grew up, and where he shot off his rockets when he was a teenager back in the late 1950s. Homer went on to become a NASA engineer, and then he wrote a book about growing up in Coldwood called October Sky, and that got made into a movie called The Rocket Boys, and Homer went on to write a few more Coldwood books, and now he's living a life, as they say. You go a few miles down a dirt road at one end of the town, and if you follow this little hand-painted sign, you can find this little square concrete pad still sitting there in this rather dilapidated-looking little park where Homer and his buddy shot their rockets off back in the late 50s. And they call it Cape Coldwood. I don't know if you can see the Rocket Boys or not, but that site is featured in a very emotional closing scene in that movie. I don't know if it was shot on site or somewhere else, but at least I wanted to be there where I seen something happen that had moved me very much when I seen it up on a screen. Well, like I said, there's not much to Coldwood now. The place is, a lot of buildings are boarded up. But at each of the three or four roads that come into town, you can't miss it. There's these big signs. Coldwood, West Virginia, home of the Rocket Boys. I guess, you know, you take your civic pride wherever you can get it these days. They even got a Homer Hickam lane in Coldwood. Well, I've never met Mr. Hickam. Maybe someday I'll get my chance. But as I drove back to my mother's home, we took a little different route back that would actually have us on a four-lane highway, I thought about some of the similarities in our stories. This writer for myself. I am far from being a rocket scientist. But one of the things that draws me to his writings, and I think drew me to this movie, was because I know exactly where he's coming from. He and I grew up in very small, very provincial, West Virginia towns in the 1950s. We each were the beneficiaries of a good education that expanded our horizons and got us beyond the boundaries of those towns. We've each written books. His got to be a bestseller. Even had a movie made about it. And since envy is one of the seven deadly sins, I won't go any further along there. We've each retained an appreciation for our origins, even as we have grown beyond them. We're about the same age. I think Mr. Hickam has about, oh, maybe 3 or 4 years on me. And it seems like we're both now looking back in the same place and trying to figure out how we got from there to here. I think that's what he was doing with his writings. I find myself doing the same thing, because there's a real pronounced element of spiritual journeying in doing that kind of exercise. And that's why it really was kind of a spiritual experience for me to read October Sky and see the movie The Rocket Boys. I don't know about Mr. Hickam's religious or spiritual path, but mine, as many of you know, has taken me to other places than where it began. It was the questions I began to ask mostly within myself, because I was reluctant to ask them anywhere else for fear of being considered crazy or being made into an outcast. I asked my questions clear back in the little West Virginia town where I grew up, and that eventually led to me being, as you know, a minister in the liberal religious tradition rather than in the conservative and evangelical tradition in which I was raised and nurtured. Raised and nurtured in a very loving and caring environment. I still have to acknowledge that to this day, even as Mr. Hickam says the same thing about the religious tradition, or about the town in which he was raised. Well, Homer asked his questions, and he pursued his truths in the realm of science. that took him and gave him a life well beyond the coal mines that surrounded him. Gave him a life beyond the life that his father wanted him to follow, and his father was a mining superintendent, and he wanted Homer to follow in that path. Questions and the truths that I pursued were not in the realm of science primarily. As you know, they were more having to do with religion and philosophy and literature and stuff like that. And they, in turn, took me well beyond the faith that my father, wished for me to embrace. And that's the connection, you see, that I really feel with this rocket scientist and writer whom I've never met. He and I both had to say no to our fathers in order to get to where we knew we needed to go. And I think that's why I broke the cold on that afternoon. Well, I still haven't stopped asking questions about my faith and my faith community all these years later. And I decided to use one of those questions for my sermon title of the day. I put it in the newsletter, put it in the newspaper as Religious Rebels Do We Matter Anymore? And then it sometimes happens when I go to write a sermon, I sit down to write it and realize that's not exactly what I want to deal with when I get to actually having to put words to paper. I decided that's not really the question I want to raise, at least not at the outset. I might get to it as we go along here. Because, you see, doing it that way makes it too predictable. You know, this is the 18th year for some of you to see me up here. And you sort of sometimes just got to figure out where I'm going before I get 2 minutes into a sermon. You know, that's, I guess, Joyce Lessons in, I don't know if you call it peril or not, the long-term ministry, but there it is. No, I could decry the increasing influence of the ideology of the religious right on public policy and how such ideology continues to trump science. The FDA's ban on approving a so-called Plan B morning after pill because it's an alleged used form of abortion is one of the latest examples I could cite. I could go on to speak about the increasing marginalization of a liberal religious voice and presence in our society. But as strongly as I feel about such things, I realize that's not where I want to go. It's not where I want to start. You heard from Pam a little earlier. If you're looking for ways to make that voice a little better heard, go talk with her. I invite you, urge you to speak and meet with her after the service today. So instead of asking, do we matter anymore, let's just begin with the question simply of what matters. What matters to us? Right here, right now. And then see where that might lead us in another year in our life together as a congregation here. And let's start with that, as I often like to do, with the personal. I would start by suggesting that we come here, we come back to this community in this fall of 2005 because we matter to ourselves. Some of us had to leave other places. Some of us had to say no to other places in order to come here. It matters to us that much. We matter to ourselves. We matter enough to step back from the busy, often confused lives that we live and search for a deeper reason for being beyond all the reasons that tend to pull us out of bed every morning, whether we want to get up or not. We value our lives enough to seek some connection for those lives. Some connection with what Paul Tillich once called that which is greater than ourselves and whose name we cannot fully know. There's a larger life. There's a sacred spirit of life that we sing about here every Sunday in which we are all held and grounded, and we come here to find that sacred connection. And one of the reasons we come here to find that sacred connection is because we can do so free of any dogma or any party line that says this way only. Our many and varied journeys of the Spirit matter to us. They matter enough to bring us here and our journeys here. But that's only where a community such as this one begins. A community is not a collection of individuals. It's not a community. That's all it is. And so we come here because we matter to one another. The late Catholic theologian Michael Novak has written in a book about 35 years ago that the two basic religious questions are, who am I And who are we? We under these stars. I'm afraid Mr. Novak and I don't share a whole lot in common these days, politically anyway. He's become kind of a leading light conservative, but I give credit where it was due. He got it right 35 years ago when he wrote those words. We're here because this question of who are we matters to us. How we attend to the joys and concerns, spoken and unspoken, the celebrations and the devastations, the hopes and the lost hopes, the promises and the pains that are visited upon all of us. That's one of the things that makes of us a religious community and a spiritual home. We matter to one another because we're part of a larger life whose blessings we seek. And I want to urge upon you, even as I urge upon myself as well, to be ever mindful that the we in this who are we matter includes those for whom this has been a home and a haven for much of our lives, and it includes the person who comes through the door and who has come through this door for the first time today. We're here because we matter to one another. And we're here because our world of people and events and nature all matter deeply to us as well. This question of who are we begins here, but it takes us as far from here as we each and all will allow it to take us, and allow our imaginings and our thinkings and our conscience to take us. Here's the thing that struck me the most about all that's happened and brought to light in the following the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. Now, I know I'm not the first person to figure this out, because you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a theologian to do so. But try this. We're witnessing such an amazing paradox over the last few weeks. We've witnessed amazing generosity, amazing good-heartedness on the part of so many who are affected just by the sight and the plight of human suffering and loss. Just within our Unitarian Universalist family alone, think what, close to $1 million has been raised. Just within your family alone. I announced last week how the UUSC has set up a Gulf Coast Relief Fund. We're up to about $1 million in that as a denomination. If you want to know a little more about that and find out what some of those particular money is going to be used for you, to Joyce during the coffee hour. One of the many joys of having an intern who's also on staff at UUA is you'll get a little pipeline here. We can ask you.
It's actually over a million.
Over a million. Thank you. See, right there. I've been corrected already. And thank you. That's amazing. That kind of response. But then in the midst of all this wonderful kindness, we've also had laid bare before us the great divides we still face in this nation when it comes to matters of class and race, and about how we attend to the needs and well-being of those who still find themselves on the outer fringes of the wealth and the power and prosperity in this nation that so much of the rest of the world sees, and sometimes sees us only in that kind of light. Our Second Unitarian Universalist principle says that we covenant to affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And I would suggest that even as this is a covenant that is binding upon us, it is one that is binding upon our society and nation as well. And in the past couple of weeks, we have seen some very wonderful ways in which this covenant is being lived out, even as we have also seen the many ways in which it still remains unfulfilled and even broken. We're here because there's a world that matters to us. And it is from here that we may discover how we are called from, for the most part, our places of privilege to the understanding. To ask who are we means, as I said earlier, we in the furthest and deepest sense of that term that you can imagine. Our human folly and our human failings, for which none of us in this room are immune, have given us a horribly unhealed world in which needless wars are fought, children needlessly die, and in which ignorance too often trumps the light of reason and understanding. And there's also a blessed and holy spirit of life, whose reaches none of us are also immune from. And it's this spirit that can give us the courage and the wisdom and the love and the kindness that all those unhealed places continue to call out for. So I'll answer the question now that I originally posed in the sermon title. I think I can do it in a very straightforward, simple, and one sentence way. If we will attend to and be faithful to the things that matter to the most to us as members of this liberal religious congregation, then the question of how much we matter beyond this community will take care of itself. And I trust it will take care of itself in some very wonderful and gratifying ways. Okay, you're going to have to hear another summer travel story before you get out of here this morning. This was a long ways from Colquitt. Another one of my summer meanderings took me about 25 miles or so to the west of Colquitt, West Virginia. So a little ways down the California coast, just south of Carmelo Lakes, for those of you who know that area. This one, the Colquitt Michelle and I went to, this one was a guy trip. Me and these two other guys kind of doing our on-the-road thing or living out our on-the-road fantasies or whatever it was. So we started driving. We stopped off of Highway 1 for a while to drive back up a little canyon there to spend a little time with a fellow who is known in those parts as the Poet Laureate of Carmel. His name's Rick Master. Rick's going to be here with us on the 23rd of October. In our Unitarian Universalist family, we know him as a writer and composer of the song Let It Be a Dance. Beyond that, or including that, Rick's a wonderful poet, wonderful storyteller, songwriter. He's also got a very moving story to tell about his own dealings with prostate cancer over the last few years. So Rick and I, my two companions, sat on the deck of his house and we talked for a little while about, and Rick and I talked about some of the things that we're going to be doing when he visits us here in about a month. That piece of the conversation was pretty short since Rick is big on spontaneity. So come and see him on the 23rd, you'll get the idea. Well, leaving Rick, we drove on a little further south to a spot called Bixby Canyon and Bixby Beach. Now, I don't know if any of you ever driven that route or not, but if you had, you know from Highway 1, the quickest way to get to Bixby Canyon or Bixby Beach is to go straight down the side of a very, very high cliff, which is something that no sane person would ever attempt to do. Now, my companions and I were a little crazy, but we weren't stupid, so we didn't try that. The other way is to drive inland a little ways, down a mile or so of a dirt road, until you come to a more smaller road that goes into this little place called Bixby Canyon that will take you to a set of woods that will eventually get you to the beach where you can look back up those cliffs and see the highway. Well, I've long wanted to visit Bixby Canyon and Bixby Beach. As with Colquitt, it's a literary thing and part of a spiritual journey as well. For Bixby Canyon, Bixby Beach is the site of Jack Kerouac's novel, Big Sur. I really do got this literary thing. If I read about something and I really get excited about it, I gotta go see it, no matter where it is. I don't know if any of us should do that. Maybe it's just a weird thing with me, but I had to see Bixby Beach just like I had to see Colquitt. Well, Kerouac's novel, Big Sur, is about the few weeks that Jack spent there in the summer of 1960 staying at a cabin owned by the San Francisco poet and owner of the City Lights bookstore, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It's a very sad book. It foreshadows the alcoholic breakdown that tragically took Kerouac's life just a few years after he wrote this novel. The book has a certain kind of desperate beauty to it, I guess I could say. Well, the appendix to this book is this big long poem called Sea, S-E-A, that Kerouac wrote while he was there. And I wanted to see where Jack wrote C. Now, one of the two companions I was with is a character in Big Sur. As a young boy called Timmy Pomeroy. His real name is John Cassidy. He's in his 50s now. He hadn't been back to Bixby Beach since he was 9 years old, which when Jack wrote about him, wrote about the time that John's father Neil and his mother Carol and all these people came down to see him. So it was important for him to go back to that place also. Now the problem with Bixby Canyon is it's become a gated community. You drive down the road, the main road, the little road that goes off into the Bixby Canyon, big, huge gate, padlock about as big as my fist on it, the message is pretty clear. And I've been down Bixby Canyon Road about 3 or 4 times before, and that gate was always closed and locked. I think it's because the people on the other side of that gate who have their nice little summer homes there don't want Kerouac pilgrims like me trooping past their property all the time. I can understand that. But this time the gate was open. And looking at that open gate, I realized that it is possible to question the existence of God and see a sign from God all in the same moment. I pulled the car off the side of the road, leaving it outside the gate, not knowing how long it was going to stay open. And I said, guys, we're going in. If somebody rides us, we're trespassing, which is what we're doing, we'll politely leave. If not, we'll keep walking through the woods, which I know we're there because I read about them, and then we can get down to the beach. So off we go. We made it past Ferlinghetti's cabin, right there on the right, first building as we walked through. And then a guy in a truck stopped us, asked us where we were from, which was a polite way of saying, what are you doing here? Third member of the trio, a fellow named Jerry, said, well, we're from Monterey, and we're visiting Mr. Ferlinghetti. Yeah, right. And the guy in the truck said, well, have a good day, and kept going, and so did we. Through the woods and through the beach. Hard for me to describe, really, the kind of emotional high we experienced when we got there. You kind of had to be there. It wasn't the beach so much as beautiful as it was, as the experience of getting to a place you've long wanted to be, and being able to share the moment with persons for whom the experience matters as much for them as it does for you. And that was what we shared there, kind of a common high. Non-chemical high, common high. And for the next couple of days that I was with these guys, our conversation kept going back to one or the other of them saying, man, Steve, if you hadn't said we're going in, we never would have made that trip, and we wouldn't have had the experience of getting back there at Bixby. Well, I thought they were overplaying that a little bit, but I'll take it. And I've since decided that open gate is my metaphor for our upcoming trip here and our year together. It's a metaphor I offer for you as well as we continue to hear to be about the things that matter to us, even as it mattered to me and John and Jerry to get to that beach. Look for the open gate. You may not always recognize it as such, but look for it. If you find you're needing some greater fulfillment or wholeness in your life, consider that open gate rather than a locked gate and stay on your search. And bring that search here, for there are people for whom such a thing matters as much to them as it does to you. Because for us, the mind and the spirit are also open gates. We're the church of the free mind and the good and open heart. The gates of exploration are always open, and they're always unlocked here. And when you see a human need, when you see an injustice, when you see a wrong that needs to be righted, consider that an open gate rather than one locked and before which you have to stand feeling helpless and impotent. So the gate is open here. And there are persons for whom the vision of a more healed world matters as much to them as it does to you. And whether you wish to call it a sign from God or not matters far less to me than yours and our willingness to walk through whatever open gates we may find in our shared life as a liberal religious congregation in the weeks and months ahead. So let's be on our way. And as we do, let's sing together number 318, Who Would You Want?